This is Howard McConaughey, March 20th, 1993. Facing the image and giving image a face.
Howard McConaughey, facing the image and giving image a face. This workshop will offer practical application of the theory of art therapy. It will involve picture making following an introductory talk. Image work will follow, then a second picture and more image work.
That's better.
Okay, thank you. Now that projects. Okay. Facing the image, getting a little closer, in other words, coming face to face. And then a final thing will be giving the image a face. So let's just begin by, if you need to get up and go close to the images and there's something you want to talk about, begin with whatever comes spontaneously to whomever. Does that sound like a good thing? Just if anyone has anything to say about their feelings about what's up there, or their feelings about their own work, or about a particular one, about anything, it's a free conversation. You look like you want to say something.
Then I started.
Echoes of other things are important to mention, and so I would always, if you were a client of mine and did this and talked about trees that way, I would give that experience too, and some other experiences. How many of you have been in Santa Barbara, California? Have you seen the big tree, that huge tree there? It's one of the most wonderful trees. And the roots start from the trunk about this high and come down, you know, clear as far to the corner. And so that in between them, you know, you could, in fact, homeless people make their homes in between those roots. And the trunk is this big around or something. And these huge branches are bigger than trees up going past you. It reaches clear across the street on one side and clear, you know, it's a huge, some kind of fig, little figs about the size of the end of your little finger, so you couldn't eat them, I think. But there's one in Santa Monica, too, but not quite as big. But trees are wonderful people. So I didn't, I hadn't thought of telling that story, but you brought it up, and I think it's a good to relate these things. That other tree. Anyone else have a good tree story or a tree of memory? Oh, good. Uh huh.
Uh huh.
Those two images there. Through a lot of it, yes. And that's important, you see. I stand before my whole past, or the whole past of the human race, like a tree with roots there, but moving on and out and up. A kind of a rosy sky behind the second tree, and this new phase of life. There's a very interesting, there's a book with an interesting title, which I haven't read. I bought a copy over here on the table from my wife. It's about, what is the name of that book? The Measure of My Days, which sounded good. And my wife can't bear growing old. She thinks she's ugly, and I think she's beautiful, more beautiful than she was 20 years ago. So I thought, oh, I'll just buy that book and hope that it's saying the right thing for her. So, interesting point, too. Uh, as real grounded. There's an interesting kind of just a general curve to both of them that gives them both a similar character, that the part of, you know, it'd be interesting to see what you do next week and next month and next year, and to see how often we find that kind of movement like that, and this second tree moving that way too, as a, and go ahead. No, go ahead.
At some point, you can't see it there, but I realized you need straight lines. I need straight lines. Uh-huh. Of the same curve here.
Uh-huh.
And you can't see it, but if you're very close to it, in the second one, not the second one.
Yeah.
It's like so a kind of change.
Something kind of stabilizing about being 60.
Yeah,
that's it.
Oh, no. Well, you probably can say that, but it's true.
I can always say it, anyway.
The tree might be, it looks like a strong tree, but it's flexible.
Yes. Yeah. Strong and solid, but not rigid. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you can see on that beautiful 60-year-old face, you know, that kind of strength too, and that's something that the young bride can't have. It's a different kind of beauty. Yeah. Okay.
Another one, which is when I think of intensification, I can kind of scanning at it fairly clear which two, you know, what the pairs are. Some of them are not so clear to me.
Uh-huh.
But in some places it looks to me the matter of simplification, some places that whole image changes.
Uh-huh.
In some pairs it seems to be a different form of the same.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of colors and energy. Fascinating how
different people use a different method of getting closer and more intense and involved. Yes, very interesting point.
Some of them, the ones I can't figure out what the pair is looking at.
Uh-huh.
The one next.
Well, do you want to ask someone?
No, there are a couple, like there's one in the far, the color piece in the far left corner. Are the two above it? Do they go in that?
No. I think, no.
Black and white?
No, so
there's
just...
The black and white is not not the same person. Is it?
Yeah, she just worked on that.
So the intensification that in that case was not another thing, but reworking the first one, right? Uh-huh. More curves.
Are they left or right in sequence?
They're on right to left.
Right to left.
Curve to angular.
So it moved the other direction there. Do you want to say anything more about them?
You know, that's an interesting point you brought up about the angularity of it. I guess I wasn't really consciously aware that. I guess maybe being possibly aware of just angles being more intense or sharper, that could have tied in that somewhat. But it was also a response to the blots of ink that were left on the paper in the first piece, and I drew straight lines to those, like connecting the dots, and then I just filled in everything from there on.
And in spite of you, and that's your homework. Yeah, but we're going to leave today without doing the third one in this kind of series. We're going to do a third something, but we're going to break just a little bit from this image. You know, got in touch with the image, we faced the image, and now we can do more, but then I'm going to sort of say, let's hold that so that it leaves you with something that you want to go on with, and let's, when I make the next assignment, I'm going to ask you to do something different and a little more specific. Yes? Yes. Facing the image. And then we're going to give the image a face. Yeah. Let me talk a little more about that when we're talking about these. Image, of course, is always the image of ourselves. That's all I'll say right now. Anyone want to say anything more about it? Yes? Yeah. Well, I can't do it, and so I won't. That's not very humble, you know. I won't try anything I can't do. Yeah. I've got to succeed. You know, that's our whole manic, heroic society, you know. But we tremble, we're ashamed, we're humble when we say, yes, I'll work at it. But excuse me, go ahead. I just wanted to bring those points in. Yeah. So, and now, how did you feel about the second one?
Well, the second one, consciousness,
morning. To very fairly close to Mount Rainier, you know. And we've been flying, and there are all these beautiful mountain peaks with snow, and then all of a sudden, in among all these big, high mountain peaks, came this huge, gorgeous Mount Rainier with its snow. Something very monumental about a mountain. And so in our humility sometimes we say, well, I'm not going to be momentous and mountainous and monumental. And sometimes it's, psyche says, well, you are. In spite of it, you know. Maybe it's robes, maybe it's hair, but it's a monumental mountain too. When you talk with a client like that, then they begin to feel monumental or mountainous. And that's what's helpful. You know, that's what I was trying to say last night, too, about that immensity that comes back from the world is what's healing, not what I can do as a therapist. Yes? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's not just a little insignificant someone here. It's a, yes. Well, there's that too. In this monumental thing is this humble me. This ashamed Navajo point. It's shame, like, you know, like blushing. You know, if all of a sudden I should take off all my clothes, not only I would blush, but all of you probably would blush. You know, that kind of shame is a humility and a blushing. That's and yet there's nothing wrong about a naked man. You know, it's a beautiful shape too, but somehow we'd always some of us would turn our faces away. And I would tell yes, were you going to say something?
Oh, I just think that shame and humility is very different. That's my opinion.
Yeah. Well, they can be, and yet they can be very similar too. I mean, I don't think that Navajo poet, when he said, I'm ashamed before the sun, I'm ashamed before them, meant, I think it meant a different kind of shame. I think it meant a humility. And so, really what I'm trying to point out, that, you know, there are always these two or more sides to every question and every word. That's why the word season I used in a double or multiple sense, too. Thank you, though, for pointing that out.
I'm not sure if it ever would know. I think that once there is running, it's a shame. 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 It's a
shame. Look up the root, the Greco, the Indo-European root of shame. And because there you get multiple meanings. That's where we go. The American Heritage Dictionary, for many of the words, has the, in the back, has the Indo-European roots. And then you can see our words, much lies behind each word also. What stands behind each word. And that's carried with the word as we use it today. And if we don't know it, psyche sometimes knows it and brings it out. But it's important for us to get in touch with that too. Jeanette Paris, who wrote pagan meditations and pagan something else comes from Quebec, Canada, and she said in a talk at the Festival for Archetypal Psychology in Notre Dame last July, there's no therapy without awareness. I'm saying pretty much there's no therapy without without attention, paying attention, which turns into awareness too, as well as the self-compassion. Okay? Yes.
But I feel like there's a connection there with what you're saying about humbleness and tender. And I'll read what I wrote about my book.
Good.
Which are those two pieces on the internet. Out of the mist, a lotus emerges, birthed by dark hands and fire, trembling in fear, trembling in the ecstasy of being fully born.
Wonderful. Yeah.
The second one was the...
But the figure more clearly defined in the second one. You may want to finish something that you felt you didn't have time to finish. And that could be homework. And the other is that you may think, well, a third one, I might really be able to say it better a third time. You know, Raphael didn't just paint one gorgeous Madonna and child and say, well, that's it, you know. I've done it. 56 he painted during his short lifetime. What was it, 23 years? 56 Madonnas. Yeah. Besides all the other things you think. things that I think every therapist has to look out for every moment of his work as a therapist. And one is that kind of judgment about the individual. And the other is the follow-up that... And if he'd just do this and that I tell him to, that would make him well. There's something terrible about him, but I can fix it up. So yeah, you hit a very tender point. Not with me, not only with me personally, but with any serious therapist, I think. Wouldn't you say that? So all you wonderful Jungian analysts and therapists of all kinds. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, that's a help. A big help. And the... It's a big help. That whole tradition of therapy, you can go back to the tradition, in art and in therapy, you know. Reading Freud helps, because although Freud is pretty... egotistical about knowing what to do, and Jung to a lesser extent, but and then Hellman lesser yet. Reading these people, and Mary Watkins and all the people that we're talking about, that's the much that stands behind us, that we stand before like a tree. So there's a tradition is important, not as just as tradition for itself, you see, because that is what we stand before, where our roots are embedded. And we can find in the lives of therapists and in the lives and letters of Freud, we can find much more humility than in the stories about how to do psychoanalysis. That helps us too. You know. But it's an archetypal thing. You know. We are... No matter at what age you become a therapist, we are Cynics. dogmatic, this is the way it ought to be done, and this is what you should do, and do it. I know, and I can tell you. And then we're sucked into it because the patient comes and says, oh, there's something terrible wrong with me, and my mother did it or something 50 years ago, and I want you to help me, you know. And Jung himself said somewhere, you know, I always tell the patient, I can't help you, you got to do it yourself. And then Hillman would say, I can't help you, and you can't help yourself, really. But you can get in touch with psyche and see that it isn't because you're just a stupid ass, but because you're human, for God's sake. And humans, the most perfect human, is vulnerable. I don't know why it came into my mind, not only just now, but yesterday or something, that old song, that I know you're not an angel, but still I guess you'll do. So so until a time that one comes along, I'll string along with you. You know, an angel ain't going to come along. That's what Hillman's talking about by pathologizing. You know, we're all pathological. Don't just point at you, and you, and you are pathological. I'm pathological. Because archetypally, you know, people are.
So is Hillman.
Yeah, so is Hillman, yeah. And so is Jung, and so is Freud. So is Freud. The farther back we go, the more we can see their pathologies. You know? And so I can see a little bit in Hillman, and more in Jung, and quite a bit in Freud. Not very much in myself, of course. But don't you think I'm pretty normal? But no, there's no such thing. Thank God. Oh, probably not. Yeah, yeah. And even from thinking there is an answer, see. There are many answers, and we don't know all of them, or maybe none of them. Yeah, good. Okay, back to the images. What time are we supposed to stop?
4:30.
It's about 3:30? Okay, anyone want to say anything more about the images before we do something else? Yes. Uh-huh.
And I'm just curious,
which is the first and which is the second? Is there anyone else that wants to say something? Is there anyone who hasn't said anything or whose work hasn't been mentioned that would like for it to be or would like to say something? Another poem by Antonio Machado. I don't know the name of it. I somehow didn't get that. And then give you an assignment. We'll work on that. We probably won't have much. And the same thing that the poet David White said that I quoted in the talk last time. But, you know, in a different way, and one will be more important to some people and strike some people and another others. But he says, it doesn't matter now if the golden wine flows abundantly in your crystal cup or if the bitter juice clouds the pure glass. It doesn't matter now if the golden wine flows abundantly in your crystal cup or if the bitter juice clouds the pure glass. You know the secret passageway to the soul. You know it. You don't have to be good. You don't have to go to school and study. You know the secret passageway of the soul, the road that dreams take, and the calm evenings where they go to die. There the good and silent spirits of life are waiting for you. And one day, they will carry you to the garden of eternal presence. So I'm emphasizing again the presence. That's Antonio Machado. And then I guess I should do one more. Because I'll make the assignment and then do this one more. It's by David Wagoner from the University of Washington, who took Theodore Retke's place. I have was going to do some of Theodore Retke's also, but we can't do everything in 2 days. And I want to do Derek Walcott's Lost. How many of you know that? Wonderful one. Walcott takes Native American teaching stories from the tribes and makes poems of them. And I use it often when someone says, well, I can't draw it, you know, because a poem... in the poem, the youth has come to the elders of the tribe and saying, you know, well, what do I do if I lost? If I'm lost, I guess I'll read it anyway. Okay, and so the elder speaks. He says, "Stand still. The trees ahead and bushes beside you are not lost. Wherever you are is called here. And you must treat it as a powerful stranger and ask permission to know and be known. The forest breeze, listen. It answers, I have made this place around you. If you leave it, you may come back again, saying here. No two trees are the same to a raven. No two branches are the same to wren. If what a tree or a branch does is lost on you, then you are truly lost. Stand still. The forest knows where you are. You must let it find you." So that works nicely. You know, when you, well, I don't know how to draw, and you're an art therapist. Okay, just stand still. Just let it happen. And then... Retke's poem, The Waking, you think I'm a poetry buff or something, won't you?
Why not?
It's called, it's from a book called Who Shall Be the Sun by David Wagoner, W-A-G-O-N-E-R. And the poem is called Lost. This book was published in 1978. By Indiana University Press, and the poem's on page 5. But now the one I was going to read. But you know, it just helps your face. So what I want you to do is draw a face that people will recognize as you. And this is to help you out on that. It's the poem, by the poet David Walcott called Love After Love. You know, I said, talk, nothing happens, nothing creativity doesn't happen without love. The day will come when with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door in your own mirror. So, you know, we don't want to use a mirror for this. We want to draw from our own mirror. The day will come when with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door in your
own will be. The important thing is that much stands behind us, giving us something to stand on. I stand before it like a tree with roots in the soil of the past, which I have inherited. As Hillman says, we need to have real contact with the forces that are shaping the kairos, that is the right moment for a transition, that is shaping the future. And to have this real contact is to come to terms with the kairos, as he said from my, I quoted him last night. But here's the first stanza of the Rilke poem, which I did read last night. I am the rest between two notes. I'm the rest between two notes, which are always in discord. because death's note wants to climb over. And in the dark, eternal, reconciled, they stay there, trembling. And the song goes on, beautiful. Now, what is trembling? What is that trembling? The trembling between past and future. We tremble with excitement, with expectation, or we may tremble from fear or shame or humility. Can you feel that trembling now in yourself? The song goes on beautiful only if it springs from the trembling. It doesn't matter whether it's joy or grief you're experiencing, says David White. The only thing that matters is, can you tell the story so well that the story is magnificent? If you get in touch with the trembling, the story will be magnificent. That's where art schools fail, and art education, if it's taught right, succeeds. To get in touch with the trembling rather than to learn perspective and proportion and color harmony and all that. I started to say shit. But I didn't say it.
You said it.
Oh, I said it. So let's just take a minute to relax and get in touch with your trembling. You may close your eyes if you wish. Where are you in your life right now? What are you feeling? Check your breathing. What makes you tremble? Is it humility that brings us in touch with this trembling? I am ashamed before earth, before heaven and dawn, the Navajo poet says. I'm ashamed before my patient or client, before therapy. I'm ashamed before fatherhood or motherhood. I tremble before these workshop participants. Now, whenever you're ready, get your materials and start making a drawing of what you are feeling. And when you shall have finished, we'll look at them and talk about some of them. No one has to show their work or to present it to be discussed unless they want to. But let's see what we can do in, say, 30 to 45 minutes. Okay, I'll read that one over and then the next one. My words are fine and I can speak so well from this place of embrace. Each word a drop of dew, transparent, a fat blueberry. Isn't that wonderful? A fat blueberry. How I can sing from this place of embrace. My song is a merry trill in the trees. How I can laugh. My laughter is silver like a new moon. And I can weep softly from this place of embrace. Each tear rolls slowly down the face, becomes a pinch of salt for my food. So this is sort of a joyous and a positive sort of thinking. The other one shows a little bit more of the dark. It's called Sounds in the Garden. It's a child's cry in the garden among tulips blooming, white daisies. It's a weeping, a sobbing. And when I follow the anguish sound, I cannot find the human figure, the body to comfort, hold, or rock. Only the weeping is heard in the garden among summer flowers on a warm night. It is the sorrow of the child left in the trees. you know, the sort of uplifting and joyous experience, which already in the first poem says, but I can also weep softly from this place. Or that's always missing, a child's voice, the sorrow the child left in the trees, death's note wants to climb over, but the song goes on, beautiful. All right, let's take a little break, then we'll come back, and anyone who wants to, we can start and have some time talking about, looking at and talking about these images, and then maybe do one. Who says, man is made for joy and woe, and when this we rightly know, then through the world we safely go. Joy and woe are woven fine, the garment of the soul divine. So if it's psychotherapy, soul care, then joy and woe are both woven fine, and we can't do away with it. You see, our society, our manic society, wants to do away with the dark. But it's there all the time. So who would like to sort of show your work to the group, and then we'll all talk a little bit about it, do a little bit of image work. And all right. Oh, excuse me. Okay, I just picked up this book from the table over there. It's The Blue Fire by Hillman, because it has one little short quotation that might help us begin with the image work. Page 55, under the heading Responding to Images, and that's what we want to do now. He says, imaginational morality is essentially not in my judgment as to whether the daimons I behold are good or bad, nor does it lie in the application of imagination, how I put what I discover from images into life's actions. Rather, this morality lies in the recognizing the images religiously as powers with claims, with a claim on us. So, thank you for letting me borrow this. So then let's look at the image. I think the first thing is just sort of to see what's there. Think, look at it, think about it. Maybe if I hold it over here, where can more people see it from here? Or all right, yeah. Who wants to just describe what they see?
Reminds me of Arabic writing.
All right, they're the shapes, the green shapes that look like Arabic writing.
It's as if on an ancient sacred wall.
Okay. So that even though there is a relationship to Arabic writing, it's also a flame-like rising. Flame-like, but in a green, cool color, rising from the warm colors. Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's bright.
It kind of reminds me of the red, reminds me of the earth, the center of the earth and all the molten fire there.
So there's fire and sun and life. Music, and of course there are the horizontal lines there over which these green flames or Arabic letters are, or notes are. Yeah. It's always artists very often turn their work upside down so they'll see it fresh.
Yeah.
But Our therapist, I think, should never do that. Because it's a different image. And it doesn't, you know, unless the person who's working with it turns it while they're working with it, then we shouldn't, as therapists, shouldn't turn it. But yeah, there are these lines across, and then the wider, thicker, non-linear areas. Yes. Something rather exotic, distant. Do you want to just hold yourself for a second if it has something like it? We won't say anything about it. You don't have to.
Actually, I was drawing grass.
Yeah, okay, so there's something.
I got into the
skeleton. Yeah. Sure, yeah. See, some similarities there. Okay, and the idea of the earth that someone suggested. Yes.
I think the lines is kind of really, the green lines are intriguing to me, like something is jumping around. Maybe in the garden, the two lines could be some kind of a fence around the fence. Mm-hmm.
So there's life again. There's a real rhythm and movement in those lines. Yes. Snake, the image of the snake.
Uh-huh. I think of a division, though, for me, the tension between the two sections, the red and the yellow, and something restricted in the body.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Maybe you want to pass it around now so that people can see it closer. So this is the first time that we've mentioned that one of the very obvious things that is a division into two sections. And then relating differentiating the two sections.
Looking at it closely enough, too, you can see the echoes of the green shapes down in orange shapes.
Uh-huh. And so those shapes that make the red echoing the green are freed from the back, from the dark underground, as this man was saying, and rising above in that one.
You know, my very first impression is of a secret language.
Mm-hmm. It's secret for him, too. It's psychic language, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That it has that.
Has that double possibility, yes. Every archetype has its negative aspect in it.
Yeah, it's very difficult. I couldn't see all the shapes.
Yes, I think that we need to pay close attention to the world, and this is part of the world now. Yeah. Isn't that wonderful? Here we have something, a part of the world that was never here before. Let's see, is that moving around now? Is that? See, giving it that attention gives it more importance. You know, oh, it's just something I did, you know. And we just had 20 minutes or 40 minutes to do it, you know. But look what we've. We've given it the attention that it deserves. Often, you know, the things we do ourselves, we don't give the attention they deserve. And unless we take them that seriously, they're not going to take us very seriously. And then we don't get the magnified return back from the world. If we ignore it, it's going to ignore us. That's another thing, the reason that I was worrying about the space around you as you were working, you know. If you just, we've gotten so well, there are all these neon lights that aren't good for us and all the acid rain and air that we breathe daily and we get so used to not roaring at the enraging desert, that now to really get in touch with these things, we have to pay more attention and not be used to it, object to it. This is what Hilma means by concern with the soul and the world. You know, we've got to stand up and say, hey, it's got to stop. I'm not going to live in this hurrying. My life is not this steeply hurrying hour, you know. And we got to say, you know, and so I'm going to start living my life.
Electrical
snake-like.
Kind of
yeah. Yeah. So that the red is not just as red as they think. There are orange shapes similar to the green shapes in the red,
oh,
which blend together.
And you don't see them.
And you don't see those. Did you all get to see them there, back there? It's coming, really coming this way, but did you get to see him? Yeah. A magnificent sort of presentation, presence. You know. Paying attention makes the presence known. Imagination makes a presence known in the world. Makes a presence known here.
All of this talk of it and passing it around, it feels as if we're really honoring it.
Right. And that's probably enough, you know. Then we don't have to say, well, of course, it's split in the middle, so this red man, he's really schizophrenic. Well, isn't that foolish? But that's what our therapists tend to do, you know, to try to find out what it means. You know, what does that mean? You know, what does this mean? You know, what do you mean, Forsythia? Broken off your branch, yeah. We can really see how foolish we are sometimes just by, and then we can use the term exaggeration. Who was it last night that spoke about exaggeration? Yeah. Yes, of course. Do you want to say something about it? First about it, and then also about our reaction to it.
I started painting about 3 years ago. I haven't painted now for about a year and a half.
Uh-huh.
But I had an intense period that emerged after getting sober, actually, about 5 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I used to paint daily. And the same themes always emerged because I've never
uh-huh.
painted before.
Uh-huh.
And that was the split, the horizon,
uh-huh.
with something below and something above.
Yes.
Often, I like to work with, it's kind of a graffiti type of shapes that look like language or
uh-huh.
letters.
Like runic letters sometimes.
But I don't recognize what they're, they don't have any logical meaning.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But they have a psychological meaning.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but basic motifs, that's somewhat similar, but not
mm-hmm.
the suspended. I don't think I've worked with like a suspended image like that
uh-huh.
before in the upper
uh-huh.
half of the picture.
So that's interesting, too, that there's this development going on, like it does in all of our work. Yeah. That now this is the first time that this suspended thing in the upper part has happened, he says. Good. And how do you feel about what we've all been saying and doing to your image with it?
I've never showed any pictures, so
uh-huh.
I like the idea of, you know, people actually looking at it and handling it.
Yeah.
And, absorbing it sort of, you know.
Good for you, yeah, sure. Paying
up. It's not really understandable.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I don't understand it, so.
Yeah. We understand in a different way than
yeah.
than we usually use that term. Yeah. Getting in touch with it. Yeah. Okay, shall we? Yes.
I just was thinking, you know, it's so hard to resist, certainly those of us who are
prone to categorize, and mm-hmm. I've studied art therapy as an investigative tool.
Yeah.
When you see things that seem to fit diagnostic criteria, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. like there's a three-heart syndrome, you know, mm-hmm. where often if people draw three hearts, you know, it'll be a triangulated family and so on. It's got this extraordinary reliability. So,
yeah.
So yeah. I don't know if you ever had that.
I think it's in the air. We all have it, whether we admit it or not. Just my constant awareness that's there. And Hillman said one time, and I hated him for it at the moment, that maybe you have to do that and move away from it. But I hope that you can not have to do it and then move away, but that since it's in there, it's affecting you, and you have to just be aware not to. That's really all. Yes.
I think the same situation is in doing any kind of therapy.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And whenever it starts to slip over, that sounds kind of. I would pull myself back and realize that there would be uniqueness to the person, and it's truly intriguing.
Yeah. This is why in our day, image is much more important than symbol, you know, because they snakes, and then you know what the snake means. We look it up in Cyril, even you know. It has nothing to do with what he's saying here. But seeing it as an image, then we have to take it as an idiosyncratic, unique thing. Let's move on to another image. If someone else wants to, all right, and then... okay, anyone want to describe this one? Describing.
I can hold it up over here so people have to.
Yeah, it's not. So he said he could hold it up and everyone hand it to him. If it went around real quickly, and then we talk about it, it can go around again more slowly. Yeah.
Just send it around.
Let's do that. Is that me? Oh, that's me. Now pay close attention to me. I may have not have said anything last night or this morning, but there was my speech. Yeah, Cage would have loved that. Do you want to say something about what you did or feel about it before we start talking about it while it's going around?
I really like this process because I think it's the first time where it's very rare that I ever feel comfortable about just drawing something without thinking about it. I mean, uh-huh. Something that feels true.
Uh-huh. Good.
That feels really good. Because usually I do it the other way, or I think of, I like a snake today or something, and I'll draw a snake. Uh-huh. And then really try to make things fit into that. But this feels really freeing.
Good. Okay. Okay, anyone who's seen it want to say anything while the rest of us are waiting to see it?
I have an advantage. It's interesting because it looks like here a tree is growing upside down, which is really interesting. And the sun behind. And then I'm seeing some sort of interesting energy happening under the feet.
Under the feet.
Possibly. I'm not sure.
Much stands behind me. I stand before it like a tree.
The roots also come down. The tree is upside down, but there's roots.
That was my, you know, seeing from a distance was, that was my first sort of.
And the contrast of the expression on the face with what one thinks of a breath is nurturing.
There's a real contrast there. Of course, the press and Mother Demeter receiving Persephone today. Yes.
I didn't experience it as breath, but rather as movement.
Good. Energy. And maybe a nurturing energy nonetheless. Yes.
It looks like the building is leaning toward her.
Yeah. Did you notice last night that sort of landscape with a house on a hill by Soutine that I used for distortion? The buildings in Soutine all lean, and the roads move like a snake, and the trees almost fly. Yes. All right, the connection, and that might be one reason the tree is upside down.
And the tree form actually looks like a conduit of sorts. And then, you know, the idea of different earth.
Yeah.
But I remove that shape away from, you know, a tree actually.
Mm-hmm. What's...
Are you thinking about these?
Yeah, and then above as well, you know, where they just follow it out throughout.
Yeah.
That
whole line from the tree to the house and the person coming down. Yes, yes. Interesting, isn't it? Nice connection. Yes, that's very interesting to mention. See, and then there are two things we must first, when we think about that, and I'm glad you brought that up, then we have to ask the artist, you know, is that an empty space that was there or on purpose, or is it partly because we didn't have time to do more? So that we, you know, I mean, Psyche had something to do with our lack of time, as much to do with it as I. You know, I'm going to take the blame for it all. So it's there, but also we have to take into account that with more time, she would have probably done more on that side. But we know also that she worked on this side for the time she did have, on the left side. Well, it's there, you see. I mean, it's there.
And it also can be connected somewhat with the writing window.
Yeah, I'm seeing one there.
One thing that's interesting that I see going on is that we were going to pass around quickly so they all
can
see it. And then you are holding on.
Yeah.
Let it go.
That's right. It's very interesting, yeah.
There's always, there's the personal and the archetype.
Now here's another one where we might want to turn it upside down for a moment. Yeah, it's okay.
About the house, there are two windows.
Uh-huh.
It looks like a side of the house.
Yeah, it's only a part of the house.
The other
part would be off. And it's tipping. Someone did mention that it's tipping.
And also it seems like she almost wears a tree on her head.
Uh-huh. Nice, you see. That's a nice image. See, turning it upside down, the house is still tipping, but it's tipping the other way, and it's not as heavy, it's top heavy. Yeah. So that, you know, this isn't the image. This is the image.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's reaching over strongly to the home and to her.
Some forms of this art theory is the life force of the person.
No.
So it is interesting that it's growing out of the head in one sense, and on the upside down, the person is growing out of it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's that same feeling, you know. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
The other thing that I see is that there's a tremendous sensitivity of expression in the face.
So that
to me, if I would look at it, one of the things that I would feel that this is a person with a great sensitivity of expression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. Uh-huh. I always think that it's important also to make any analogies with other works of art. For instance, you know, I immediately think of de Kooning's Woman, number one, number two, and so on. And I think it also gives it a little bit of importance to say, well, you know, there's some similarity between that and this artist's work that sells for $50,000 a painting. You know. Anyone else here sold a painting for that?
Three-dimensional to see what sort of...
Uh-huh.
Since it doesn't have a lot of detail as far as painting.
Good. Do you want to say something about it while it's being moved around?
So you asked us to image the place of our trembling.
Uh-huh.
The first thing I saw in my mind's eye was a green shoot.
Uh-huh.
And
so you had the green.
And as I sat down a little bit in the foyer,
So is that an animal with the green shoot?
Another
tree, yeah.
The place of my trembling is a young green stem emerging from seed in some warm ground. I am a young green stem twisting, turning, climbing under and upon the great old oak, now withering, now sleeping, aging. Although I am the seed of this great warrior king,
another example of how poetry and art tie together. Yeah. And Zahana was saying that she does work and then the poem also. I think art therapists ought to know all the poems in the world. I don't know very many of them, but I know a few. But they're important, yeah. Because, you know, when we talk aesthetically or poetically or metaphorically, it helps the client to work metaphorically or aesthetically, you know. Instead of talking about the proportion or, well, you know, the chimney doesn't really grow out of a house like that or something, that's not real, the child couldn't get into that little door in your house and so on. But talk about home and you know, read a poem that, that talks in the same mode, or same mood, not mode, because poetry is one mode and art another, same mood, helps the child or the adult, the client, to work in that mood, rather than in a rational kind of mood, but let's see, how tall is the child in relation to the, or the father in relation to the child, and so on. Sometimes the child's larger than the parents in pictures, or the child is often larger than the door to the house. So one teacher said to the to a child, just in art education, it wasn't an art therapist, well, you know, and it was raining, the child was outside, and the child would never get in the house to get in and out of the rain and to keep from getting wet. And then the child thought for a minute and then laughed and says, well, he'd never get wet, those are just crayon marks. So the child is father of the man. Yeah. Of course he won't give a yes.
I have a question about earlier you were mentioning that you might see a drawing that would remind you, let's say, a face and then it would remind you of a de Kooning face. So how would you bring that de Kooning image in?
Well, but there are two things that we talked about that we could see right there that we talked about first is what looked like it could be large breasts and then a very expressive face and somehow maybe a sad or distorted face. So in talking with the client, we talked about that. And we said, well, you know, there's a contemporary painter named de Kooning who does women and that somehow are somewhat similar. And it just so happens that I have an art book here along with all my poetry books. You know, you got to have them there, or at least get them by the next time. I run to the library and get with a picture of a woman by de Kooning. How does that strike you? You know, and they might say, I don't like it. You know, and then so that's fine too. You know. But just to sort of, it ties into the roots. You see, much stands behind me, and one thing that stands behind this, whether we know his work or aware of him or not, is de Kooning, you know, and Picasso. And that's why the poet didn't say much stands before me. You know, that's one reason he said that, because somehow it's like your diagnostic tools. It's in the air. De Kooning's in the air, even if the client has never seen a de Kooning or even a reproduction of it.
So if he showed it to him, he thought he or she then it would sort of expand the
kind of culture of the culture, of his total culture. And also, you know, he may say, I've had the experience where they say, oh, I want to do another one now. Not copying de Kooning, because then I put it away. He's only seen it for a couple of minutes and never saw it before. But enriching the image that he's got. You know, I don't have my poetry and art books here. I did bring some poems along. But you know de Kooning? Have you seen his work? I mean, just... Yeah. See, it'd be nice if we had one here just to show you for a few minutes. And okay, yeah. We might be able to hear the important sounds now. Good, thank you. Okay, shall we do one more? Yes, you said you wanted yours. And maybe we can do two. I want to then get down to doing one more image before lunch if we can, but let's... See if we can get maybe a couple more.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.